From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen. This Thanksgiving Day, we'll hear how food banks are innovating to meet the needs of the hungry in the U.S. That's just ahead. First, though, we go to Mumbai, India, where coordinated terrorist attacks began last night, killing more than 100 people. The attacks occurred throughout the city at sites like the Oberoi and Taj Mahal hotels. Arif Doctor is a lawyer living in Mumbai. We reached him today at his home and asked what the city looks like.
From my home, we're seeing or hearing presently nothing. Last night, we heard three explosions, which we were told were hand grenades, at about midnight and half past one in the morning. And we were told those were hand grenades thrown out of the Oberoi Hotel.
Do you know anyone personally who has been at any of these sites that have come under attack?
We do. We know someone. I'm a lawyer, and there's another fellow lawyer, two fellow lawyers, who are in the Oberoi, very senior lawyers. Who are in the Oberoi. We had contact with them till about 4 or 5 in the morning, and after that we've had nothing from them. They were in a restaurant which is on the ground floor of the Oberoi. One is called the Tiffin and the other Kandahar. And since that time, we've had no contact with them.
The army has been brought in. Do you get the sense at all that things are getting under control? How safe are you feeling?
Well, in our homes, we are safe, really, because now it's isolated at three points in Kulaba area. But the reports say there were about 25 terrorists and there could be local support, and they're on the loose. So that leaves a very unnerving feeling, because if they're on the loose and they are on a suicide mission and they're not, they could strike at any point of time. So it does definitely leave an unnerving feeling. As long as you're home, you're secure. But one doesn't know what to expect tomorrow.
Mr. Doctor, I understand that you are a Muslim. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah.
So far, there has not been official confirmation of who's responsible for these attacks, but they have been attributed, at least in part, to Islamic militants. How do you think the situation there might affect Hindu-Muslim relations in Mumbai?
Well, the people claiming responsibility are an outfit called the Deccan Mujahideen, and one doesn't know the veracity of that, whether they're a front, they're not. But hopefully, one hopes and prays that this won't deteriorate into a communal incident or communal clashes. We'll stand together. And I think Bombay has so far stood together and realized that, look, these are international acts of terror, and one can't hold one particular race or religion responsible, because no religion or race preaches such inhuman acts of violence on innocent people. So I hope and pray that this stays at an international act of terror from people who are misguided and irresponsible and doesn't escalate to anything more. I sincerely hope and pray that's what it stays at.
Arif Doctor spoke to us from his home in Mumbai, India. Thank you for speaking with us, and please stay safe.
Thank you.
This week, we've been hearing about the services this country offers to people in need. Yesterday, we heard from Michael Flood of the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank, who told us use of their food pantries is up 40%. Today, we hear from three states where people are going beyond the traditional canned food drive to meet demand. We'll start here in California.
From Redlands, California, I'm Kimin Sung. A team of orange pickers work like hummingbirds, briskly extracting fruit from Valencia orange trees. They're picking the fruit for the Inland Orange Conservancy, a community-supported agriculture group based in the Inland Empire. Director Bob Knight.
We have these legacy trees that are really old, and the older the orange tree, the sweeter the orange. So we have this real jewel here in Southern California.
Members pay $65 a year to receive 10 pounds of local oranges every week. Leftovers are donated to local food banks. Also, the Inland Orange Conservancy harvests fruit from trees that would otherwise not make it to the market because they are either too small or blemished.
Farming in general, there's a huge amount of leftover produce that's just part of the process. And typically that produce just gets plowed under, taken to a landfill. But by having these groves right next to an urban population that has poor people that just really need fresh food, it's possible to take that fresh produce to them directly.
And the need for that fresh fruit has gained urgency because the Inland Empire is one of the regions hit hardest by the housing bust. When the Conservancy started donating fruit 3 years ago, they gave a half ton of fruit to the needy every week. Now, they donate nearly 8 tons. And distributing 8 tons of fruit every week? That requires the help of hundreds of local volunteers.
Come on!
Jim Frazier and his dog Jesse came by the packing house to pick up fruit.
On Fridays, I do Girard's. On Tuesdays, I go to Augie's, which is a coffee shop here in Redlands, and then I go over to Riverside.
71-year-old Barbara Wormser of the food bank Inland Harvest has also come by to pick up the oranges, grapefruits, and kiwi fruits that fill up her Honda minivan.
My son says the car smells, but I pick up a lot of food.
Her first stop is the Central City Lutheran Mission.
Let's get you some fruit.
Yeah, let me get the shopping cart.
Yeah.
Pops QB Snow, who helps run the shelter, says he's seeing more people line up for help. And everyone's glad to see Barbara.
I appreciate it every day because I know what it means to be hungry because I came from the street, Inland Harvest. Okay. If it wasn't for her, we wouldn't even eat. If it wasn't for Bob, we wouldn't even eat.
Pops then loads his cart with the fruits of the Inland Orange Conservancy and wheels it into the mission. For NPR News, I'm Kimin Sung in Redlands, California.
This is Laurel Morales in Flagstaff, Arizona. Local butcher and hunter Dennis Champagne has donated thousands of pounds of elk, deer, and buffalo meat to the Northern Arizona Food Bank over the past 5 years. This Thanksgiving, he'll give 6 deer and an elk to the hungry. That's about 1,400 meals. Champagne is a paradox. He's a butcher and a hunter and a sentimental animal lover.
I have 3 cats, 3 dogs, bird, a couple fish. I love them.
2 of his dogs wag their tails fervently at his feet. They probably like what they smell. Champagne greets me with a fist bump because his hands are covered with blood. As we enter his processing shop, the smell of raw meat is overwhelming. A huge skinless buffalo hangs from a hook. Champagne and his crew are cutting the buffalo into T-bones and porterhouses and grinding up what's left to make buffalo burgers. Champagne's crew wields carving knives, handsaws, pretty much anything that's sharp.
What's that noise?
That's the saw. That's the bandsaw.
Oh, okay.
Meat saw.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
She makes little pieces out of big pieces, pretty much.
Outside where it's quieter, Champagne explains how he got into hunting as a teenager.
My dad bought me a rifle for Christmas.
Tears come to Champagne's eyes.
My 12-year-old, 10 years old, his first animal was a 2,800-pound buffalo, and he dropped it with that same rifle my dad gave me. So if, I get a little choked up, it's because that's why I enjoy hunting so much.
He says sharing that joy is what it's all about, whether it's helping a new hunter get his first kill or providing meat for families less fortunate. About 5 years ago, the food bank asked him if he or his customers had any leftover meat to donate. Usually, Champagne can talk them into donating at least 10 or 20 pounds. Over the years, it's added up.
I'm up to approximately 33,000 pounds of meat, and I'm pretty proud of those figures.
Champagne is part of a national program called Farmers and Hunters Feeding the Hungry. The idea behind the program isn't new. Historically, hunters always provide it for their communities. Back inside the shop, the crew has finished the buffalo and is working on an elk. As Champagne watches their progress, he recalls his last hunt.
This last animal we got, I knelt down and said a prayer and petted her. Sometimes it chokes you up, but then once that part's all over and you're enjoying a nice roast or a nice gorgeous elk burger, You can't beat it.
And when it comes time to sit down at the dinner table, he says he's always grateful. For NPR News, I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
From New Hampshire, I'm Dan Gorenstein. 11 students sit in a nondescript room at the New Hampshire Food Bank in Manchester. It's the first day of their 8-week culinary training course. Chef Jason McCarter asks his new students to introduce themselves.
My name is Wayne Richmond, and I've had a drug problem most of my life.
My name is Kenneth Samar Jr. My most recent job was being a dishwasher for the dairy field. I had to, end up quitting because of the fact that, I made some poor decisions.
Most everybody in the room tells McCarter how life has knocked them around. Part of what attracts folks to the program, Recipe for Success, is that it isn't just learning to cut carrots or prepare pasta. The goal is to get students, all either unemployed or earning meager wages, into better-paying jobs. McCarter understands that, so he tries to deliver a practical education.
You know, I can train somebody really quickly on how to make this dish and how to make that dish, but I can't train them quickly on how to think on their feet. What happens if you need 50 portions of this one entree and half of your chicken went bad?
McCarter says after 260 hours of kitchen time, after food safety certification and positive reinforcement, he brings in chefs from nearby restaurants.
They actually got a chance to work with the students, and they were all really surprised how fast they were able to get things done. And that's showing that to them in advance is going to go a long way when it comes time to get these folks jobs.
8 of the first 10 students to graduate found work within 2 weeks. The New Hampshire Food Bank collects perishables like meat, poultry, and fish that can't be distributed. But instead of good food going to waste, McCarter and his students use it to make meals for kids at the Boys and Girls Club in Manchester.
When you see a little boy come up for seconds and thirds, and can't look you in the eye, but he'll come up and shake your hand to say thank you, you know, it brings a tear to your eye. There's people out there that are hungry.
The most recent Recipe for Success class graduated earlier this month. But with the economic downturn, it's getting harder to place the students. At the same time, more and more people are applying to the program. David Roberts knows how tough it is to find work. He's been looking for the right job for over a year. He's so excited, he's already made up a list of dishes he wants to learn.
Duck. I'd like to try and learn how to cook duck, because I heard duck is really good. You know, or I tried shepherd's pie once. I didn't succeed. So I'm hoping this class will help me make a good shepherd's pie. Me, I'm not one for mixing hamburger and mashed potatoes and corn together. But other people, that's how they like it.
When I ask Roberts what he'll be thinking about this Thanksgiving, he says, Monday, coming back to class. For NPR News, I'm Dan Gorenstein in Concord, New Hampshire.
If you'd like to see some photos from one of these food banks, please go to our website. It's npr.org. Stay with us on Day to Day from NPR News. This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen. Today, the crew of the Space Shuttle Endeavour is getting a little bit of downtime. They'll have a Thanksgiving dinner of irradiated, freeze-dried smoked turkey and some rehydrated green beans and cornbread. Back here on Earth, folks will be hard at work at Mission Control in Houston, and one of them is John McCullough. He is the Chief Flight Director at NASA. Thanks for joining us, Mr. McCullough.
Happy to be here. It's a great day to be in space.
And what about there on the Earth? What's going on there where you're working?
Well, today is starting to wrap the mission up day, so it's been a little bit quieter. As you mentioned, the crew has some off-duty time, and we have some time to get our thoughts together and get ready for undocking tomorrow.
And so what does that involve? What are your tasks for today?
Well, they're finishing up their transfer. They've got about 5 or 6 hours left to transfer to get everything settled into the middeck. They transferred the module yesterday back into the payload bay, so that's completed. And they're just closing things out, getting ready and saying their goodbyes, and as you mentioned, having their Thanksgiving dinner and taking some pictures and enjoying the moment after 4 EVAs and a lot of work inside of the station.
Some folks get a little bit cranky about having to work on the holiday. It's a day that, you know, most of us spend with our family and friends. How do you feel about working on a day that most people get off?
Folks that work at NASA have a common bond of a real passion for the space program, and so we wouldn't be here if we didn't have that. And obviously, we'd like to be with our families, but if we can't be there, the next best place to be is working on a space mission. So, you know, we've been doing space station for 10 years straight, and there's been someone here every year for every holiday. And beyond holidays even, you know, one of the crew members on board is having their wedding anniversary just yesterday, and tomorrow is one of the birthdays of one of the flight directors working the flight. So we all kind of bond together and take care of each other, and we're having a Thanksgiving dinner here that management's all bringing in for the flight controllers that are working, and we try to shift people out so that, you know, there's 3 shifts so that people do get some time at home.
What do you eat as part of your meal? Do you also have the freeze-dried food as a kind of motion of solidarity with your comrades in space?
No, we take advantage of the fine available food here in Houston, and we bring food in full up Thanksgiving meal, so it's really good.
Well, I hope you enjoy it, sir. John McCullough is Chief of the Flight Director Office at Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas. Thanks so much.
Thank you, and have a great holiday.
You too. Before he was elected president, Barack Obama gave a speech in Philadelphia about the roles of race and religion in American life. In that speech, he talked about his church in Chicago and other black churches throughout the country. He said they are places that house both the love and the bitterness that make up the black experience in America. But as Monique Parsons reports from Chicago, some people argue not all black churches are alike.
People seek out churches for lots of reasons. Inspiration, a relationship with God, a sense of community. Derek Bounds was looking for history. And he found it. Earlier this year, the Chicago musician joined Quinn Chapel African Methodist Episcopal Church, the oldest black congregation in Chicago. The stone and brick exterior first caught his eye, but the story pinned by the door of the fellowship hall drew him in. Free men and former slaves built the church in 1893. Its founders first met for prayer in 1844.
When I first heard that, I really didn't think of black people even being in Chicago at that time. I was still thinking, okay, we're in the South.
Bounds says he chose this congregation because, like Barack Obama, he finds inspiration in such a historic community of faith.
Well, when I think about the black church, when I hear that term, I think about all of the sacrifices for myself. I think of all of the sacrifices that have come from our black ancestors.
I think it's kind of a holdover from the past.
Curtis Evans teaches African-American religious history at the University of Chicago. He understands many people like to speak of the black church, but he's one of several young scholars who say it's time to ban the term.
We say that there should be a moratorium simply because the notion of the black church, this persisting notion, obscures the diversity of African-American religious life.
That history is a lively corner of the academy these days. And not just because race and religion were hot issues in the presidential campaign. Combing through archives and attics, doing field research far from church pulpits and the press, historians are breaking new ground. Paul Harvey teaches history at the University of Colorado.
We have a tendency to think that there's this thing called American religion, and then there's this other thing called black religion or African American religion or something, and it's important to understand how much those two were connected from the very beginning.
Harvey met with colleagues in Chicago recently for a sort of state of the union of his field. Their scholarship places African-American religion in a more global context and in a brutal, complex world where blacks and whites interacted far more than most people think. They met to celebrate the 30th anniversary of Albert Rabiteau's book Slave Religion. It tells the story of how African slaves didn't just absorb their slaveholders' Christian faith. They adapted it, blended it with African customs, and made it their own. The slave trade itself forced worlds together, connecting Europe and Africa with the Caribbean and the American mainland.
I always say, you know, globalization started in the 16th century, 15th century, so these globalization discussions are not new.
This story of the early multicultural America fascinates Toni Morrison, whose latest novel breathes life into the racial and religious hodgepodge of 17th century America. It also inspires Jelaine Schmidt, a young professor at the University of Virginia. She studies Caribbean folk religions like Santeria and Voodoo to see how Africans in the Americas shaped new traditions. And while the Reverend Martin Luther King famously called Sunday worship the most segregated hour in America, Schmidt teaches her students American Protestantism caught fire in a very different world.
During the Great Awakening, especially the First Great Awakening in the late 18th century, blacks and whites were going to those camp meetings together. There was a lot of borrowed behavior going back and forth.
Many whites disapproved of this mixing, Schmidt adds, and the context could be fraught with tension and pain. Schmidt and her colleagues watched with fascination this year as race and religion and their own scholarship became dinner table debate during Barack Obama's presidential campaign. Many historians saw their research jumping off the page. Back at Quinn Chapel AME Church in Chicago, the Reverend James Moody says these issues aren't simply scholarly debates, and he commends Barack Obama for bringing race and faith into the national conversation. Moody was in his car when Obama's speech on religion and race came on the radio. He pulled over and listened to every word.
I thought it was just a watershed moment in American history, actually. And we'll see. When you and I are gone and the history books talk about that speech, and the changes that came out of it through this election, we'll see what the history says, right?
All around him, Reverend Moody sees myths falling. In the election, yes, but also in the delicate brown-skinned Jesus painted above his altar 50 years before the Black Power movement, and in his solid stone church, built by a community of free men and ex-slaves in the cruel era of Jim Crow. For NPR News, I'm Monique Parsons in Chicago.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen. In a few minutes, creating a new holiday tradition, the National Day of Listening. First, though, the U.S. Commerce Department recently reported the largest monthly drop in retail sales since it began keeping records. But there are some bright spots in the world of retail. We hear about one of them today as part of our series this week, giving you a little break from all that bad economic news. Lisa Olivares manages a kiosk. It's called CCE Headgear. It's at a mall in Fayetteville, North Carolina, near Fort Bragg. I recently gave Lisa a call on her cell phone while she was working at the kiosk.
We do custom embroidery. You can either bring in your own items or we provide them for you.
And we're hearing from you on your cell phone at the kiosk now. And we should note that where you are is not too far from Fort Bragg, which is home to the 82nd Airborne Division. And apparently a lot of those soldiers have been coming home. And how has that affected your business?
Well, I mean, all the economy's been affected, but we're not as bad because luckily we do a lot of things for the military. Their wives are still here, so it's constantly them bringing in things that they need to be shipped overseas or just little minor things for the babies. It does keep a good flow in, though.
You mentioned the babies. I hear there's been an upsurge in the birth rate there, 50% more recently. That's a lot of babies.
All the troops came home at the first of the year, and now everywhere you look, it's women pushing strollers or they're pregnant.
And so what kind of stuff are people bringing to you at your kiosk there for these expectant mothers?
Well, so far our most popular are the cloth diapers. They use them as birth rags, and we just did a series for the first 504th Charlie Company, and it has their crest on it, and the women buy them and give them as presents to each child that's born in the unit.
So it sounds like it's kind of a point of pride for these soldiers that they want, you know, everyone to know that their baby comes from them and that they're with a certain unit?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We get the Rangers that come in and get their crest on their baby shirts, or we do the onesies that say, "My daddy served in Iraq."
What are you, Lisa, most thankful for this holiday season?
I'm thankful I don't have the banks on my butt. Does that make any sense?
It does. Do a lot of other businesses there locally that might not be affected by the baby boom? Are they having a harder time?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's constant. In this business, in the mall, with the kiosk business, it's people who come and go and can't keep up consistency. Like I said, the economy is bad, but I still have a job because we have our loyal wives that still come in here and get stuff done.
Lisa Olivares is the manager at CCE Headgear Plus in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you.
Today, Lisa Olivares will get the day off, but quite a few of us don't. We're checking in with people who are on the job today. Joining us now is Barb Weber. She's the zoological manager of primates at Disney's Animal Kingdom in Florida. Hi, Barb.
Hi, Alex.
How many animals are you minding there today?
Myself, I am minding about 35 primates, but there are more than 7,000 animals here at Disney's Animal Kingdom.
And what kind of primates are you taking care of?
Well, we have very large ones. Gorillas are our largest, all the way down to cotton-top tamarins, which are probably about a pound.
You've been there for quite a few hours already. How's the day going so far?
My morning has been fairly busy. I went down to our gorilla area. We have a gorilla that has some teeth issues, and we were brushing her teeth. We did a dental rinse on her and getting them ready to go out in their habitat for the day. And I went early this morning to our mandrel building and was checking the exhibit. We just were doing some rehab work, and mandrels went out for the first time in several months.
Mandrels is a type of animal?
Yes, it's a primate. It's actually one of the largest monkey species there are. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Rafiki from the movie Lion King. Rafiki is a mandrel. They have extremely colorful noses and rumps. And like I said, they're one of the largest monkey species.
Do the animals get something special to eat considering it's Thanksgiving?
keepers that are responsible for the day-to-day care of the animals do make some special treats for the animals. For example, our gorillas, on a daily basis, they get sweet potatoes, and on Thanksgiving, they may add some nutmeg or cinnamon to the sweet potatoes to make it kind of reminiscent of being home with family on the holidays.
Barb Weber is working today at Disney's Animal Kingdom. Happy Thanksgiving, Barb, to you and your animal friends.
Thank you so much, Alex, and the same to you.
From NPR News, it's Day to Day. Later tonight, I will be hosting dinner at my house with friends I invited, which hopefully will keep the meal mellow because we all tend to see eye to eye on most things, but not everyone is as lucky. If you find yourself sharing a table today with family or friends who don't share your political views, well, fret not. Slate.com's chief political correspondent John Dickerson has put together some ammunition to help you should the conversation turn to politics. He joins us now from his home in Washington, D.C. Hi, John.
Hello. Happy Thanksgiving.
And to you as well. John, you have for Slate provided backup to both sides of the argument on a number of topics. Let's start off with the financial crisis. Now, let's say that your Aunt Edna is a Democrat and your cousin Joe's a Republican. What argument can each of them make over the pumpkin pie as to who's to blame for all this mess?
Well, let's see. For the ones who want to blame the Democrats, you can start off by saying, look, this wasn't a Republican problem. It started in the Clinton administration. In fact, the signature banking deregulation bill was signed by President Clinton. In fact, it was championed by Larry Summers, who's the incoming head of the National Economic Council for Barack Obama. So don't blame the Republicans in the current administration. And oh, by the way, it was the Democrats who were relentlessly blind to the dangers building up at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Now, if you want to blame the Republicans in retort to that argument, you can say that, well, but the Bush and the Republicans deregulated even further. They watched a lot of these problems fester, did nothing, that Alan Greenspan, a Republican and a hero to Republicans, played a big role as well, pushing the deregulation of derivatives. And then, of course, you can go to the present day and argue that Henry Paulson, the head of the Treasury Secretary, has had at least three different strategies for the bailout, and none of them seems to be working. And so that might be pushback against the argument that this is all the Democrats' fault.
John, let's move on next to President-elect Barack Obama's cabinet. As it comes together, some folks say this is the change he promised on the campaign trail. Others say it isn't. What are some good strategies to argue here?
Well, those who say it isn't changed say, well, look at all the old former Clinton administration officials, including Hillary Clinton herself. That's not change at all. The Obama folks, of course, would say, well, change starts at the top. This will all come from President Obama, and he's just picking experienced people to carry out his change.
You mentioned Hillary Clinton. It's expected that after the Thanksgiving holiday that Mr. Obama will formally announce her as his new Secretary of State. Good idea, bad idea?
It's a great idea, say those who think she knows the issues, that she has a standing and strength so that she can tell him what she believes with the bark off, you know, and that she'll be a strong voice. Of course, there are others who say, terrible idea. The drama of the Clinton family will be rumbling all throughout the Obama administration. Her husband's conflict of interests will be constantly a problem. So they're the ones who would say it's a bad idea.
John, on a personal note, I hear you have quite a few relatives coming to your house for Thanksgiving. How many?
We have 22 this year.
You are a brave man. You think there's going to be any political spats at your table?
Well, we don't. The entire house becomes the table with that many people, so we won't actually have room for argument. Anybody who wants to bicker will have to go outside.
John Dickerson is the chief political correspondent for Slate.com. Thanks, John, and happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
And now an update to the major news story of the day. The death toll in Mumbai, India, following terrorist attacks there stands at more than 100 people, including several foreign nationals from Australia and Japan. Indian commandos have been going from room to room trying to free people trapped inside. Two luxury hotels, the Oberoi and Taj Mahal. More coming up in just a moment. This is Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Alex Cohen. There's a new holiday tradition this year starting tomorrow. StoryCorps, the project that brings you personal stories of everyday Americans, is encouraging you to take part in a National Day of Listening. Here's what you do. Set aside about an hour to record a conversation with someone you love. Several years ago, my colleague Madeline Brand interviewed her father, Gerhard Brand. He was an English professor here in Los Angeles. Gerhard was born in Vienna in 1927. He was Jewish and lived a comfortable life with his mother, sister, and his grandfather, Jacob. Gerhard's father had died of an illness when he was a baby, so Jacob was like a father to him. Gerhard told Madeline that in 1938, he watched Hitler's forces march into Vienna and take over Austria. It was called the Anschluss.
I was 11 years young, if you will. Still, you can remember lots of things at that age, and I recall the enormous pressures upon Jews in all kinds of ways. And, of course, Jews weren't allowed to own shops after a while. Jews weren't allowed to have bank accounts and so forth. So, no, it was with typical Teutonic efficiency. The pressure on the Jewish community was step by step turning the screw more and more tightly.
So Grandma had to get rid of the pharmacy?
Yes. She quote-unquote sold it to so-called Aryan, i.e. Gentile people, but the sale was under pressure and obviously for less money than would otherwise have been available.
And what was it like at home? Was everybody distressed?
Nervous, very nervous. Nervous, frightened, obviously. Fearful. Yeah. And some people had been taken to concentration camps. Some came back after a while. Some didn't. I remember before we had to leave the 13th district, which is where our home had previously been located. I remember worrying about gangs of Aryan kids who would whip Jews, you know, just walk the streets looking for Jews to beat up and to whip. And I usually was able to avoid them because I looked out for them. But I remember one case where I didn't, and you know, I was walking and they came up behind me and started whipping my legs. And luckily for me, I thought, I could escape them. In the next block was the apartment of a school friend of mine, Jewish. And so I went up there and he was home and I stayed there for an hour. And I thought they had an hour or so. I thought they'd gone by then. And I came down and they were still there, you know. And then my own home was several, five or six blocks away, as I recall, and I'd run as fast as I could, and they were whipping me all the time. So, you know, that's a memory that stays with you.
Do you remember the day you left?
Yes. March 25th, 1939.
And do you remember the day in detail?
Well, yes. I recall most vividly my mother's father, of course, accompanying us to the station where the train was leaving, and I remember all kinds of nervousness. And then the train was pulling out of the station, and I was a bit astonished, quite astonished, to see my grandfather break down in tears. You know, the tears were just streaming down his face because he had never done that before in my presence. And I always thought of him as being a very self-disciplined, hard-minded man. And he was that, to be sure. But, I mean, this was overwhelming. He knew he wouldn't see us again.
Do you consider yourself Jewish first, Austrian first, or American first? All of the above, none of the above?
I think American first, yeah. I like the hopefulness that many people have. I like the energy that dominates the country, opportunity, freedom. I'm Jewish primarily because other people think I'm Jewish, and because since there are only a few million Jews left in the world, I would feel they were deserting Judaism by renouncing it. Notice I've said nothing about religion because I'm irreligious.
Well, what does it mean to be a Jew?
I haven't really figured it out. There's so many varieties. If you will, being Jewish is an accident of birth. But since that occurred in my case, I would feel perfidious if I renounced my Judaism.
Because of the Holocaust?
Primarily. I think of the Holocaust every day. It's, I think, the most horrifying event of the 20th century. And it certainly has deeply influenced my view of human nature, which is pessimistic. And you have a paradox. I have good friends. I like to think I'm a good friend. I believe in friendship. I believe in love. I believe in the arts. I believe in the occasional beauty of nature. Notice I say occasional. And that's about it. Those are all my beliefs.
Those are pretty strong.
Yes, I think they're worth living for.
So you think you've lived a good life?
Yes. No, speaking for myself, I think I've been fortunate. Obviously fortunate to get out of Europe just before the Second World War. Fortunate to find a career which I enjoy, because I do enjoy teaching and I like to think I'm good at it. And I've been fortunate in both my marriages, fortunate in my children, and fortunate in my friends. I have some very good friends to whom I'm devoted, and vice versa. And I think that's saying a lot. I'm glad you enticed me into this interview, and here we are on the record, and my remarks, I realize, will resound through the ages, and when you have children, you will play them back this tape, and they'll know something about this geezer. Yeah. So here I am, all set for immortality.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madeline played a longer version of that interview with her father, Gerhard, at his funeral in 2004. If you would like to conduct your own interview for the National Day of Listening, you can get some tips on how to do it at the website nationaldayoflistening.org. Tomorrow, we'll share another father-daughter conversation, this time from me with my dad, Kip. Back now with Day to Day and Something to Whet Your Thanksgiving Appetite. This is the story of Man Bites World. It's a blog written by 26-year-old Noah Galutin. Noah lives here in Southern California, home to thousands of ethnic restaurants. Earlier this year, he devised this challenge for himself: eat the cuisine of a different country every day. On day one, he took on Mexico.
Mexico is sort of the cuisine that's been with me my whole life. It's sort of every step of my gastronomic evolution. You know, whether it's you're a kid and you're having quesadillas and nachos, you know, when you're growing up and you start having, you know, cowhead tacos and things like that.
Yes, Noah is a brave eater. He'll eat cowhead tacos and just about anything else, and then he'll write about it on his blog. Man Bites World is his online chronicle of this culinary journey around the world. I joined him on day 70 at Azeen's Afghani restaurant in Pasadena. Delicious. Yeah, thank, really you. Thank you. Over cups of hot cardamom tea, Noah explained the parameters of his quest to eat food from all over the world, starting with rule number one. No cooking for himself.
That's not going to be very indicative of the cuisine, you know, stealing someone else's recipe online and doing a bad job recreating it. You know, I can't order stuff from online, canned fish or something, and have that sent to me. And really just, you know, the main one is, you know, no days off.
And with this, the first course arrives.
Alrighty. Oh, wow. Here we have the chef's combo.
Our waitress, Leticia Ruiz, brings us a plate piled high with Afghan appetizers.
Okay, here we have mantu, which is a steamed dumpling stuffed with lamb and onions topped with yogurt and vegetables. And over here we have sambosa, which is chickpeas and ground lamb.
There's a bit of a science to this. Noah carefully photographs each plate to post on his blog. He takes extensive notes, and then comes the fun part.
This is, I think, the battered eggplant with yogurt and meat sauce on top. So it looks appropriately crispy and creamy and meaty. And so let's see. As promised, it's really, really good. It sort of reminds me of Italian eggplant dishes. I had a lot growing up as a kid. My grandmother's Sicilian, so I grew up eating a lot of Italian food.
You hear a lot of people say that food is a way to get to know a culture. Do you get a sense when you go to these places and you sit down and have a meal, do you feel like you actually get to learn anything more about the country that it's from?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I mean, you look at, I mean, food literally is a country's history. It's, when you look at, you know, poor people finding ways to make cheap cuts of meat delicious. And that's where cooking comes from, and that's where great cooking comes from.
Noah has been at this for nearly 3 months now, and though the okra stew from Ghana was nothing like the sweetbreads from Argentina, he has found that food, no matter where it's from, has some universal themes.
Comfort food is one of the most amazing subplots of all of this, because it's amazing how certain cuisines really do translate instantly and fairly universally. I mean, Ethiopian food, pretty much everyone that's ever tried it, I've found it, likes it. There are many people who try Ethiopian food and go, oh, that stinks. There's no reason that Ethiopian food should necessarily be accessible to, you know, somebody who grew up at Olive Garden. But people enjoy it, and that's really interesting to me.
That was delicious.
Oh, thank you.
Really good.
Yeah.
Really.
How do you like the sauce?
Really good, yeah.
Our appetizer plate wiped clean. Leticia brings on more dishes, a savory sautéed butternut squash, cauliflower stewed with tomatoes and onions, and an entree that looks like a beautiful orange-colored bird's nest.
This is actually kabili palau. It's actually a basmati rice. What they do is they sear it in lamb sauce to make it brown, and then it has the raisins and carrots on top.
It is delicious. But as we eat, Noah tells me not all of his meals have turned out this well.
I had a pretty abysmal cowfoot stew at this Jamaican place. I mean, one of the worst things I've had, honestly, so far is overcooked chicken. People are terrified of getting sick, I guess, so they destroy the lovely bird by overcooking it. And, you know, I'd rather eat cowfoot stew than really dry chicken.
In addition to bad bird, Noah has also faced the issue of abundance. How do you choose one Chinese restaurant in all of Los Angeles? Noah didn't. On day 73, he and a group of his friends tackled 11 Chinese places in 11 hours. As you can imagine, all this eating takes a caloric toll. Luckily, Noah seems to have the kind of speedy metabolism you need to do this sort of thing. Even so, there are days when this quest is a lot to stomach.
Because, you know, a lot of times you are having the specialties of a country, and sometimes I was having Bulgarian food. So what's the typical side for this? That's really, you know, something that you'd recommend as a nice typical side. And he goes, oh, French fries with cheese on top. And I'm like, all right, you know, you got to get it. You got to go for it. But I was really hoping he'd say salad that day. Didn't work out that way.
There are other challenges in finding a different country's cuisine to dine on every day. Even in Southern California, it's tough locating a place that serves fare from Uzbekistan or Mozambique.
Amazingly, Scotland and Wales are really difficult. New Zealand is kind of difficult, although now I have some options for that.
Noah has received some help. Readers of his blog have chimed in with their recommendations. A few have even invited him over to cook him food from their homelands. But back to Afghanistan and our lunch.
So I'm going to give you, that way you could share.
Though we are both feeling full, how can you resist dessert, a pudding made with almonds and rose water?
Wow, this is thick and wobbly. Here you go.
Thank you.
This is a very white, creamy concoction with pistachios on top, and I'm excited to give it a try. Mm. Oh, wow. Yeah, it's the rose water makes it sort of like...
It's like eating a garden.
What you thought eating potpourri would be like when you were a kid.
But tasty.
Yeah.
It's days like this that Noah imagines he could keep up his blog for a long, long time. But the world is only so large. There are only so many countries he can conquer.
So how will you know when this is truly done?
When it's, I go through a full day and haven't been able to find anything new to eat the whole day, then that's it. I mean, you know, the sun is down, it's 11:45 at night, and you go, all right, I guess that's it. I don't know, you pop in a frozen dinner and have a glass of wine and call it a night.
But at least for now, the journey goes on. Today is day 85, American. Noah Galutin will be eating a proper Thanksgiving dinner at home. To see photos from our meal and read Noah's blog, go to our website, npr.org. Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Alex Cohen. Happy Thanksgiving.